they do two things at once. One, they fall in love with their idea, and two, they're so convinced it's awesome they don't want to tell anyone else about it. Right? They're going to steal my fabulous idea.
Right.
Right. My advice is tell everyone about the idea.
Hey there, Powder Keg fans. This is episode 107 of Powder Keg Igniting Startups, the show for entrepreneurs, leaders, and innovators building remarkable tech companies in areas decidedly outside of Silicon Valley. I'm your host, Matt Hunkler, and today we'll be talking with Jeff Reedy, the founder and CEO of Scale Computing, which is an Indianapolis-based company that is the industry-leading application platform for edge computing. We'll talk a little bit about what that is. Edge computing environments that covers anything from global retail to manufacturing to financial services and government. Really cool company based right here in Indianapolis, Indiana. We are in Scale headquarters right now. And Jeff is a serial entrepreneur with years of experience as a leader and executive who has started and led numerous companies. I hope we get to talk about some of your past companies as well today. Raising millions in venture capital for his own ventures as well as for others, and has helped guide amazing companies from just an idea all the way through exit. Jeff, good to have you here, man.
Absolutely.
Thanks for agreeing to do this.
Yeah, no problem.
We were grabbing beers a couple months ago at this point, probably. Yeah. I think I got you enough beer to the point where you said, okay, I'll do it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it doesn't take much. I love talking about entrepreneurship, and I love beer, so
hey, you got there me you go. Both. So. We should have scheduled this for later in the afternoon. We could have made it part two. I definitely want to talk about what's going on at Scale, because I know it's super exciting times with everything that's going on, winning awards left and right, mostly for stuff that I don't understand at all, because it all has to do with edge computing. but I want to take it back first, because you've got a really interesting backstory. And I'm just curious, what were you like as a child? What were you into? Were you always working on computers and technology?
Yeah, more or less, I would say.
Do you have earliest memory?
Yeah, well, I mean, I got my first computer. It was an Atari 800 that I got for Christmas when I was in third grade. So that for me would have been December of 1982.
That's awesome.
Is when I got that computer.
See, when I think of Atari, I think of like joystick.
Yeah, yeah,
buy
yeah.
it at I mean, a garage they, sale,
they,
kind
they,
of.
So they obviously they had that, right? And then they had two computers, one called the Atari 400, the Atari 800. They were effectively the same, but the Atari 400 didn't have a real keyboard. It was kind of a flat mat with little bubbled, I don't know, imagine like a vinyl thing with like slight little bubbles that you couldn't really type very well on
okay.
it. And then the 800 had a real keyboard. That was the big difference.
nice.
But you could put
twice as awesome.
You could put cartridges in it, just like you would if you had an old Atari 2600.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but it was a full, with 48K of RAM, full system. I mean, sometimes if you try to boot something off of the tape drive or the floppy drive, it would pop up with this error that said, please remove the cartridge if you had one in there, because this program requires all 48K of RAM. Right? So and the cartridge took 8 or something anyway. But
people today don't appreciate.
Yeah, yeah. No, I fell in love with the thing kind of right out the gate. My dad was in what we would now call IT. It was called information systems back
yep.
then. It was his doing, I'm sure, that it led to that. And I remember he had...
But it wasn't forced upon you, right?
No, it was not forced. No, I wanted one. In fact, I remember I had asked, I think, for a computer. I don't remember. But I know I did not ask for an Atari, but somehow Dad had the line on people we could pirate software from and stuff with the Atari. So that's that's what he did. But I remember he, among the stuff, was a... photocopied book on how to program in BASIC that he had done. I guess they had these things at his office, right? So it's on this, these weird spiral-bound things that he'd run through the company printer. Xerox machine, right?
Yeah.
I'm sure. And so, I remember starting to teach myself how to code out of that photocopied book, right?
That's
and then,
crazy.
And back then, you know, there were magazines at the library. I'd check out magazines at the library and, like, enter in, you know, write programs for that. And, you know, the other thing you could do then, which you really can't do now, is a lot of times you'd be running a piece of software, and if you hit the, you know, effect, you know, control break, like, you would be in the code. Like, you could then, like, print the code or sometimes even edit the code, right? I would sometimes go in there and, like, edit the game so it would say, like, written by Jeff Reedy, right? Even though it was all, you know, BS. But, yeah, so I did that, and then...
What was it about that really caught your attention? I mean, were you... It doesn't seem like something that would come naturally to me, being not sort of that engineering mindset.
Yeah. No, there's a couple of things. I mean, I love the games, right? I mean, so I
okay,
always...
Okay, so it was...
I'm still a big video gamer.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And, you know, I always joke when I get on now and I'm playing, you know, Call of Duty or whatever, right? And with, you know, typically... people much younger than me, right? And sometimes I'll get the question like, you know, how you sound older, how old are you? And my standard answer is, I'm as old as you can be to have always been playing video games, right? So like there was never really, you know, a time when I didn't have some kind of video game around. My parents had a Pong, right?
Yeah.
So
your voice has some presence, so if you're playing online,
yeah,
and playing with
yeah,
kids,
it's
yeah,
it's very noticeable, right? And so so I like the games, and you know, a lot of the like Compute magazine and stuff, when you were the coding was to like make game. I mean, they had little games that you could like write, and you know, at that point, right? I mean, the difference between the game that you would write just out of the back of a magazine and what you actually were buying, they weren't that different, right? I mean, you were basically able to create, you know, quote-unquote commercial quality games, right?
And for what commercial was putting out at the time.
Right,
exactly. You didn't have teams of hundreds of people working on one game for years.
Yeah, and then, you know, I think the engineering mindset, I suppose, right? I mean, I was always trying to figure out a way to use the computer for something else, right? So, I remember, you know, I don't know, there was some... You know, I don't think they make classes do this anymore, but the class got in trouble, like, in school, and we all, like... homework assignment was we all had to write every number from like 1 to 1,000, 1 to 10, I don't know. It was something you had to write all these numbers out, like as punishment for whatever the class misbehaved. And so I'm like, oh, I'll use the computer. So I just like, you know, wrote a little program to print. I mean, it's the simplest program ever, right? But to print out, you know, and I just printed out like 1 through 1,000,000 and like brought them in. And of the teacher's like, it's fine, right? You know, that worked, right? And, you know, I was... you know, such a geek, right? I was the first kid to ever turn in like a, you know, fifth grade paper that was on a dot matrix printer because I had like written it on the computer, right? And again, my handwriting was horrible, so I was solving a problem, right? and so, you know, all that kind of stuff. And then, you know, about the time I was, so, you know, around that same time, is when this world used to be called BBSs, right? So it's a precursor to the internet where you could, like, use a modem and have your computer connect to somebody else's computer and, you know, you could sort of do email. I think we just called it messages then. But, you know, if you had a computer, I could remotely log into your computer and leave you a message and then you would get it, right? Mm-hmm. One-to-one almost. But if I knew, you know, my other friend was going to also get on your computer, I could leave a message for him, so long as he eventually got on your system, and that's where it was. It was like a bullet. That's why it was called a bulletin board, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I got into those. My dad and I, much later, when I was probably 6th, 7th, 8th grade, like, we actually ran a bulletin board, and
was
into all that kind of stuff. And, you know, but again, kind of even rolling back a bit, I mean, younger than that, I was always into it. My dad, so again, like an IT guy, would have to go in on the weekends because stuff would be broken, because that's what happens in IT. And, you know, this was mainframes with punch cards and stuff. But I would sit there as, you know, when I was 6 or 7 and just play with the punch card machine, right, trying to make shapes out of the punch cards. It never worked. But I was like, oh, I wonder if I can make a diamond on the punch card or whatever. And, you know, so I've always been around them, right? And, you know, and I just took to them the whole time, right?
Did you ever run into some barriers or obstacles or big challenges where you were really feeling frustrated with it, or was it always just natural, easy, kind of smooth sailing?
I think the, you know, for at least the level of programming I was doing, right, I didn't find it terribly difficult. What was difficult, or what was frustrating, I shouldn't say difficult, what was frustrating was at the time, right, there was no there was no way for me to get any kind of actual education in this stuff, right? And I remember when my grade school first got Apple II computers, and you know that would have been when I was, say, in fifth grade. I don't remember exactly, but I already knew basic programming, right? And so, you know, so they had a class, oh, come learn to program, and I go into the class, and this was all stuff like that was way behind me, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I ended up helping the class. And then when I was in like sixth grade, they actually had me co-teach the eighth grade programming class, right? It was just like there was, which was great. I mean, I got a lot of experience from doing that, but I wasn't, there was nobody to teach me, right? Yeah. The programming stuff. Right?
You had a hunger for more, but there was no way to access
and
that.
You know,
and internet was not.
No, exactly. No internet.
Yet. Yeah.
Right? You know, and you could get a little bit off the BBSs, and, you know, most of it was the library, right?
Yeah.
I also like hanging out at the library.
Where'd you grow up?
Griffith, Indiana.
Okay.
So it's up just outside of Gary. So,
nice.
Yeah. And I'd read books on the stuff and whatever. And, you know, I'd probably, like many engineers and geeks, like I wasn't about to sit down and just like read the programming book. Like I'm gonna like jump to the end and like see if I can like start sucking code out of it and whatever. I do that kind of thing. And then, you know, my dad and I later, like when I was in fourth grade or so, we started building computers for, you know, neighbors. You know, if I were in college, I'd have been like the perfect Michael Dell age, right?
Oh,
I was
yeah.
building like PCs in college, but I was younger, right? So,
so when did the monetary piece come into it?
Well, you know, I think, so that's a slightly different story, but when I was 11 or so, 10 or 11, fortunate, I don't know, life is funny, right? When you look back and you think the little things that actually end up making a big difference. I had a neighbor, our immediate next door neighbor asked if I was interested in mowing his lawn, right? Because I mowed our lawn. And I said, sure. And I think he asked because it actually turned out, again, random circumstances, right? But our front yard and his front yard were actually adjacent. The grass, it was like there was just grass between two driveways, right?
Yep.
And so, you know, my mom would say, well, Mr. Mirren is older, like at least just cut his front yard because it's going to take me an extra 3 minutes, right? and these were small, like suburban, you know, lots, right? So,
right.
So yeah, so I would just mow driveway to driveway, and then eventually he's like, hey, you want to mow the backyard too, and I'll pay you, and I did that. And I thought, well, that was fun, right? Like that wasn't really that hard, and he paid me. And then, you know, pretty soon two other neighbors across the street were interested in having me mow their lawn, and so I had a little thing going. And then, you know, I'm like, oh, well, you know, I can really start making some money. So I remember I made on my computer, of course, like I made little flyers, right, that said, hey, this is what I would charge to mow your lawn. And I would, you know, I printed out a little form and I would check the box, you know, with a manually, right, and drop it in their mailbox.
Yep.
And
it's like a quote, basically.
Yeah, yeah, like a quote, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this is marketing, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, I, lo and behold, I'd get some people would call, right?
Yeah.
And, they would do it. And they were always the people who would, like, let their lawn go for, like, 2 months, right? So it was, like,
right.
way high and
right.
a big pain. But still, I would get it. And then, you know, this continued. And I kept doing it. And then by the time I was in high school, you know, I had 50-some lawns and 3 apartment complexes. And I had my friends, you know, they were making at the time $3.15, I think, was minimum wage at the time. So they were getting that at McDonald's. And I'm like, well, I'll pay you $5. To mow the lawn.
Started building your team.
Build a team. And then I wasn't mowing lawns anymore. Like they would mow the lawn, and I would, while they were cutting the lawn, I would just go to knock door to door.
Yeah.
Because if I could get another lawn that was right there, right, it's, you know, super easy, right?
So did you like that sales part of it?
I did, I think. I mean, I you know, it's always it's still intimidating, right? Cold calling is still intimidating, but the exciting part of like getting the deal, right? Somebody says yes, and then it's like it all works, and you know, I love it. I still love. I talk to customers all the time at scale, and all my. I mean, I love talking to customers, right? And you know, making them happy, and every, you know, it's a win-win for everybody. It should be, right, in the end. And so, you know, so those two things were happening, right? So I was, you know, I very early caught kind of the entrepreneurial bug. Right. And I had the tech bug. Right. And then
perfect combination.
Yeah. And then just, you know, the timing of all that is when I went to college and actually started a couple companies with buddies while I was in college just to,
yeah.
for beer money, effectively.
In Terre Haute, Indiana. Right?
Yeah. In beautiful Terre Haute, Indiana. That's right. So.
But Rose Holman's a pretty incredible engineering school. Were you able to actually find some education at that point?
I found myself weighing over my head, actually. So it was funny, all through high school and everything, I was, you know, we had, by that point, there were starting to be, like, you know, academic competitions, and there were programming, and it was still very easy to me, and, you know, so I was always on our team, and, you know, we won all the time, like, almost, you know, a few that still burned me that we didn't win, but almost every competition I was in, we won. And so when I went to college at Rose, I thought, well, this would be easy.
Yeah.
It's just going to be more of the same.
Right.
And, no, not so much. It's funny, I very quickly learned, like, you know, I went from being, like, the best programmer in the room to, like, I'm not even on the same plane now. You know, maybe some of these guys had the quote-unquote unfair advantage because they were learning things along the way, or I wasn't necessarily. But be that as it may, I mean, they were great, and I was playing a lot of catch-up.
How did you handle that?
Poorly at first. I mean, it's not uncommon, right? A freshman in
sure.
It's a very high-end, tough academic school, right? It's known to be, like, tough on academics, and it's all technical. And so there's a lot of kids there that sort of had it easy in high school, right?
Yeah.
And then find themselves like, oh, this is way harder, right? And but then what you find out, it's a bell curve, right? So of the group that ends up there, there are still people there that seem to find it all incredibly easy. Like, oh, differential equations too? No problem. I'm like, you gotta be kidding me, right? Like, I don't even know what we're talking about. And so, so I got that. But what ended up happening, right, it's funny, like, over the course of my time at Rose, I found myself being in the best position if, a group would get formed for a project and, you know, volunteering to be the leader of the group. Right, because then I could do things. Again, going back to my knocking on doors when I was 11, I was willing to talk to the professor and keep the, you know, I remember my senior project group, like, I didn't write any code. Zero code in that project was for me. My job was to keep the professor from bugging the other, bugging the programmers, right?
Yeah.
And, fast forward today, now I got to keep the board of directors away from the engineers, right? It's the same kind of thing, but... doing that, and that was a real project for a customer, effectively. And
yeah.
I'd talk to the customer, I'd talk to the professor, I'd try and make the whole, you know, organize the meeting and all this kind of stuff. And I remember I had a professor, and he retired a year or two ago, Dr. Laxer. And he, when I was a freshman, the first what they called CS231, the first computer science course for computer science majors. And you have a group project, and he assigned the group leaders, right? And I assumed it was random, right? And he picked me to be a group leader. Looking back at, by the time I was a senior and looking back and seeing who he picked as group leaders and kind of how people worked, like, obviously he's put his, at that point, I don't know, 30 years of experience. Like, he was picking intentionally.
Yeah.
And it was great. I mean, I had some guys that were, you know, even on that team, I still remember their names. And they, you know, they were awesome programmers, again, better than me. I was still writing some code when I was a freshman and sophomore. But the, just getting in that position and, I think great teachers, you know how to extract or how to put you in a position to succeed, and that was what was happening there, right?
Do you still believe in playing to your strengths as opposed to working on your weaknesses?
100%, yeah. I think that, everybody can, to some extent, if you have a weakness, right, it needs to be shored up enough, right, so that it's not a burden, right? If you're not a public speaker, you don't need to force yourself to become like a great public speaker, but you can't be thrown into a situation where you're going to be in like a group meeting, somebody asks you to present something and you can't do it, right? Like, you need to at least be, you know, good enough there. And it's same sort of thing. Like, I find myself, like, even though I learned along the way, like, okay, I was not going to be the best coder, right, of everybody that was here, but I know how it works, right? I've got it. And now I can use that and explore these other areas. And to me, that's how we do it. That's how I try to even have my team, like, focus on what their strengths are. And we've even done some of the – sometimes I think these things are a little bit cheese ball, but
sure.
the little, like, strength finders and stuff
yeah, yeah.
like that. They do – seem to be reasonably accurate, right? I don't know to what extent they're accurate, like a horoscope is accurate, like it just fits anybody. But you know, when I've seen it pick out like different things from people that I know or members of my executive team and stuff, I mean, they are pretty accurate. And it's just like, okay, well now, and the benefit of doing something like that in, you know, kind of the group publicly is that then everybody knows, right? Yep. Okay, this is the guy who's really good at, you know, being the icebreaker with a new prospect, right? Which is a different skill set than being the guy that closes a deal, being the guy that makes the product, right? And so, you know, if everybody gets on the same page, especially early on in a startup, you got, you know, four or five people, right? It's good to know like how those roles all kind of break out. So along the way, I always, right, I never had a quote-unquote real job, right? I mean, I've had a few jobs along the way. I mean, I worked at Dairy Queen for like 3 months, right? That didn't last. But because I couldn't make the money I could make mowing lawns. I thought maybe in the wintertime I could do Dairy Queen, and I just couldn't stand it. But
at a certain point, you just got to buy your own Blizzard.
Exactly. I just forget it, right? And I'm like, maybe I could just shovel snow, which I then try to do. And I'm like, that's way more work than mowing lawns, so I scrapped that whole project. But I started, my first quote unquote real company, meaning that this had to like sustain me in life, while I was a senior at Rose Holman, such that when I graduated, that's what we did.
Yeah.
Right? And I've never stopped. Right. So, I've always, I don't know if that's hardwired or circumstantial because of all these other things I just talked about, but, that's my approach. I don't know what else I would do.
Yeah.
I tell people sometimes, like, when you start enough companies, at some point it becomes almost a curse, meaning that, like, I see problems and I'm like, well, I could figure out a way to fix that.
Right? Yeah.
And,
Are there unique ways that you've, come up with startup ideas?
Yeah, no, I mean, one of my go-to things is to make sure that I've got, right, lots of ideas, hundreds of ideas, because it's easy to become infatuated with one idea. It's almost the trap. Almost every first-time entrepreneur, at least, I see fall into. I'd call it a trap. I mean, there's clearly people that had one idea and it was wildly successful, and that's awesome, right?
Certainly the exception, not the norm.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, when I, the funny thing, like, so going back to Rose Holman, when I met the guys that became my co-founders, who, you know, at least some of them are still with me today at scale, and most of them were involved in all of my founding stage of the companies, we had decided we were going to start a company. And we had no idea what it was going to be. Like, there was no idea at all. It was just like, hey, what I want to do is start a company. I mean, my name is Scott Loftmiller, who, he's my chief product officer here at Scale, lives in San Francisco. The way I met him is he came to my dorm room, and he had a drawing of a T-shirt of Barney the dinosaur with a bullet in his head, and it said, Barney must die. And he said, hey, I'm selling T-shirts. Do you want to buy a Barney Must Die T-shirt? And
an interesting,
I'm like,
sales pitch.
Yeah, and I'm like, well, no, but I know it. I'm like, do you have the T-shirts? He's like, no. He's like, I was really just trying to figure out, like, if enough people wanted them, then I would go order T-shirts and have them made. And I'm like, I like this guy, right? And so he and I started talking and became obviously great friends, and he was one of the guys that was in this, like, well, I don't know what I want to do when I graduate. We're going to start a company, right? And so when you approach it that way, it's very natural to say, well, we got to come up with a lot of ideas,
right?
So we can vet these things and see what sticks. And so that's what we did. And it helps you avoid, like, it's so easy to fall in love with your idea. One of the biggest mistakes I think people make is that they do two things at once. One, they fall in love with their idea, and two, they're so convinced it's awesome they don't want to tell anyone else about it. Right? They're going to steal my fabulous idea.
Right.
Right. My advice is tell everyone about the idea, right? Even if they don't want to hear it. Tell everyone. Right. I suppose if you've, you know, somehow come up with a new protein to kill cancer or something, I mean, that's a little bit different, right? But even then, like, if you tell me about it, what am I going to do with that information? I don't know how to make that protein, right? I mean, I don't even know what you're talking about. I don't even know what I'm talking about right now, right? So it's, you know, what are you going to do with that? And you never know who is going to be able to help you or guide you or give you some feedback that changes, you know, changes things a bit.
Prevents you from following a terrible idea.
Yeah, I mean, even the founding of Scale, right? And so...
yeah, how'd that idea come about?
Well, you know, so it started in a couple of convoluted ways. So Scale, to slightly contradict myself, didn't actually start as purely one of the ideas in kind of my idea notebook. We had actually been pursuing a different idea that was around. We were going to do stock trading using artificial intelligence, kind of before AI was a thing anyone talked about. And we had to build effectively a supercomputer to do the AI processing. And we didn't have, you know, it was our money. So this was not going, you know, this was not like IBM's just going to build us a supercomputer. We were going to build this thing out of consumer parts, right?
Yep.
And
what year was this?
Oh, this would have been like 2004. 2004, 2005, 2006, kind of. We worked on this for a while,
yeah. Right?
And it started as like a science project, like, so the company I had before kind of this thing was in the anti-spam space, and we used AI to do anti-spam. And so the idea was very like, oh, well, we'll just use the same AI techniques and do stock market forecasting, and it'll be a magic black box that makes us rich, and that'll be great, right? And so...
I like this pitch.
Yeah, and it was just, I don't know, the science... project part of it was a lot of fun, mm-hmm. right? Trying to figure it out and, okay, new algorithms, new change this, change that. The computer kept getting more and more complicated, the physical hardware, and so we kept adding on to it and adding on to it, and there's all kinds of stories I could tell you about that, but we can come back to it if you want, but to jump to towards the end, we finally did, it was working, and we then said, okay, we're going to turn this into a real business, and so that meant a hedge fund, right? So you're going to get other people's money, invest it, and skim off the top, right? It's effectively what a hedge fund does.
Right.
And so we're like, okay, it works. I got this. And so we went around and raised the money or were pursuing. So I didn't know anything about hedge funds, right? A lot of smaller hedge funds get funded by bigger hedge funds, kind of like VCs invest in startups. It's sort of the same sort of thing.
Hmm.
And so... you know, we finally got a fund that was willing to put in a lot of money, not as an equity investment, but actually money we were going to then use to buy and sell stocks.
Like principal amount.
Exactly,
yeah.
Right. And, you know, then, so me and the guys, we were just sitting around, you and I are sitting around this wooden table. It was a table very similar to this in a garage. And said, okay, this is going to get real if we take other people's money, right?
Yeah.
Our money in there is one thing, right? And so we took a vote. There were six of us. We took a vote. One of the guys was literally wearing a hat, a baseball hat. And so I just had people like write on a piece of paper, yes or no, do we want to take the money and proceed, throw it in a hat, pass it around. We had six no's.
Wow.
And the reason was the business wasn't fun. Right,
yeah.
The science project was fun. Trying to like beat the stock market and beat the other traders was fun. The idea of like somebody's gonna give us money, we invest it. Either we're the hero or the goat, depending on if you made or lost money. Like it wasn't. I learned a little bit about myself in that. Like there was no product, there was no service that made anything better. It was just purely financial, and it's okay, right? I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. It's just, for me personally, it was not very exciting,
yeah.
And for the other guys too, and so
you got to follow what excites you.
Yeah, right, exactly. And it was just the science project part was super cool, right? I mean,
yeah.
It was like, yeah, we can make this work. And then when we had it kind of working, it's like, never mind, right? So we scrapped it, and we decided we're not going to do it.
Did you at least? Like sell it off to someone
No.
or license it?
No, it was stupid, right? I mean, because it was working, right? And this was before the 2008 stock market crash. My joke is always like we would have gone to jail either way because it was a highly leveraged model. So either it would have predicted the stock market crash and we would have made a ton of money and no one would have believed us, or it would have lost all the money like in one day, like that kind of, you know, 10% move or whatever the stock market was that day with us being all leveraged in, like we would have lost all the money if we bet wrong, and that would have been bad too. So Either way, we didn't do it. But as we were thinking about it, we said, okay, well, what are we going to do next? And so we had our idea notebook, right? Then bust that thing out again, looking through that. And one of the guys was like, well, you know, this computer system that we built for us is pretty cool, right? You know, not the AI part, right? But the parts of the AI, but not the stock trading part, but just the way that the system was built. It was built, because the way that the thing happened is that we started with, okay, there's one computer running an algorithm, and it was too slow. And so then we had to have other computers kind of network together running the algorithm. And it kept going until we had hundreds of processors, like, running this thing, which now isn't that big a deal. At the time, though, it was a major undertaking. And we're like, well, surely other people would benefit from that type of scalable, hence the name of the company, scalable architecture. Right. And so we decided, well, let's find out. Right. So again, it wasn't even a it wasn't really like that. We're just running with that idea. It just went into the notebook. Right. OK, we could do.
And this is where you're collecting all your startup ideas.
Correct. Yeah, that's right. So, you know, I had all kinds of ideas in there. I mean, sometimes I write these kind of mini business plans as I don't know, hobbies, or when I'm on an airplane or something about some idea and I just file it away. Right. And so, you know, I'd written a business plan for a brewery. We wrote a business plan for a chain of Irish pubs, right? I mean, these are the kind of things we're working on. And these were legitimately competing, like, we really liked the idea of the brewery. And so it was like, we were pursuing it, like, along with what became Scale Computing. But in the notebook, Scale Computing was written down as, idea number 64 or whatever it was. Compete with VMware. So VMware is a company that makes software that, you know, basically runs data centers. It's a software that runs the other software, right? Yeah. So not something consumers would typically be familiar with. If you're an IT guy, 100% you know what VMware is, right?
It kind of makes cloud computing possible, right?
Yeah, effectively, right? It's the idea that I've got one server, but I need to run like six servers worth of stuff. And so it sort of creates a virtual server on top of the physical server. And that's their original idea. Now it's evolved well beyond that, but that's what it was. And so they had, so at the time that we were screwing around with this this supercomputer thing, VMware had just gone public. And they went public, and, you know, I watch these things again, because a lot of times I'll see companies go public, I'm like, that's a good idea, and I just put it in the notebook, right? And that was basically what happened here, like, compete with VMware. And the stock was, you know, doing extremely well, and they had something like 98% market share in this virtualization space, that is, it's called.
Yeah.
And they need a competitor, right? 98% market share. And so it went in the notebook, and then we were like, okay, kind of put two and two together, like, this architecture we built is pretty cool. VMware needs a competitor. What if we merge those two things together and come up with this cool solution? And so... so that was a neat idea, and so then our next step is, let's find out if anyone cares, right? I mean, let's not write any code, right? Let's just see if anyone cares. And so I very cleverly went to the VMware website, and that they have a list of some of their case studies, right? So here are their favorite customers.
Yep.
I made a list of their 15 or 20 favorite customers, and then we started calling them. And
I'm sure they love that.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm sure VMware wasn't happy about it, but that's what we did. And so I'd get folks on the phone and...
cold calling.
Yeah, it was cold. Back to cold calling. Yeah, back to cold calling.
You and print a handwritten quote and
exactly.
Put it in the mailbox.
Throw in the mailbox, right? I'd throw that thing out there. And the, what my pitch was very simple. Like, hey... you know, I'm thinking of starting a company. I don't have anything to sell yet. I'm thinking of starting a company. If I could do everything that VMware does for 30% less, would you buy it? Right? That was the pitch.
Yeah.
And much to my surprise and a bit to my dismay, I was getting a lot of, no, not really. I'm like, okay. And so you're adjusting, right? And so I'm like, okay, make a couple calls, and I'm getting that feedback universally, right? Yeah. I got another one of my other guys who kind of runs, the other guy more on the sales side like me, less technical than me, but more salesy than me. We're the two that are making these calls, right? And he's getting the same feedback. And let's ask him 50%, 60%, 70% less. And, you know, I'm telling you, I'm like 70% less than VMware. And they're like, no, not really. And I'm like... what the hell, right? And so I'm like, what if it? So finally, I get some guy on the phone, and he was kind of engaged, and you know, if you've ever made these kind of calls, which I encourage anyone who's starting a company, like, talk to like step one should be talk to those who would be customers before you do anything else,
yep.
right? And you know, this guy was engaging, right? And so instead of being a 2-minute call, it was, we were 10 minutes into the call, and finally I said, well, what if it were free, right? What if I did everything VMware could do and it was free? And he still was like, no, I don't know, if I, maybe, but I don't know. And so now my brain is like going, like, I don't know, like, what is the deal here? And so I asked the guy, and it was a law firm out of California called Fenwick and West.
I think
they're still around.
Yeah, they are.
And so he was the head of IT for Fenwick and West. And I said, and he's like, no. And he's like, well, he's like, and I said, well, I, the question I had for him was like, well, how much do you spend on VMware? He's like, oh, it's a great question, because we just built a new data center. And it was, and I know exactly, it was about $500,000 we spent on VMware. And, you know, I'm a little mystified, right? Because I'm like, if I could save you $500,000 and it cost you nothing, like, that's not interesting. And he says, well, in reality, that data center, that was a $10 million project. But VMware is only $500,000 of that project. And then the light bulb went off. And I'm like, oh, like, right? What I heard myself asking was $500,000 versus zero, would you take zero? What he heard was $10 million versus $9.5 million if I go with a startup I've never heard of. The answer is no, right? And I'm like, aha. And so I get it, right? And so VMware is not, it's not an independent purchase in that way. It's part of a bigger project. And so I said, well, when that data center, what's the most expensive component? And at the time, and this is probably still true, actually, but at the time he said, well, by far the data storage.
Yep.
And he said that was $7 million of the $10 million. And I said, what if I could save you 30% on the data storage? He said, I'd write you a check right now. And so I'm like, okay, right now we're getting somewhere.
Now we're talking.
And so, so we went back and changed our plans. And data storage was always part, because again, we had this kind of compete with VMware component as well as this hardware aspect in terms of the architecture. And so we just reprioritized and said, okay, we're getting, well, first thing you just start asking other people, okay, let's stop asking about VMware and just start asking people if we can save them 30% on storage. And now, and we're getting yes, coming back. Like, okay, well, now we've got something, right? So then
asking
you
the
start
right
putting
questions.
Together, right, the right thing. And this is, you know, to take a pause on that, that this is exactly what I'm talking about. If you get infatuated with your idea, and I go and spend years and maybe tens of millions of dollars of venture capital building the VMware competitor and no one cares, like, that's a total waste of everybody's time and money, right?
Yeah.
And so, and this was, you know, this was cut off in an afternoon of making phone calls.
Is that still in the DNA of the culture at scale today?
Well, I hope so. It certainly isn't mine. I still make a lot of customer prospect calls and ask them questions. And you know, in a big company, it's a product management question, but you need to embrace it culturally more than that, because if you just, you know, product management almost by definition asks questions that tend to be more incremental in nature, like, we have this product, like, do you want these features, those features, etc., versus something way off the wall, right?
Right?
When you're a brand new startup, it's easy to think way off the wall, because you have no, if you do it before you've written any code, you have nothing, so what's the difference?
Yeah.
Right? And so in the end, we did launch originally with this kind of data. So scale computing, we were incorporated with this vision of competing with VMware and, you know, VMware Plus, right? VMware Plus the architecture. But the product that we shipped was data storage. And so we had, like, the world's most badly named storage company called Scale Computing, right? Which doesn't make any sense, but that's what it was for the first 3 years. And then as the market started to change, sometimes how we wanted, sometimes not how we wanted, but eventually it came around where the world was starting to open up to effectively a more direct competitor to VMware, and that's when we started to take the company that direction. And so today I consider VMware to be my number one competitor. Now, not just VMware, but we do data storage. We do lots of different things, right? And
was it like a decade-long journey to get there?
Yeah, 13 years.
13 years.
Yeah,
wow.
13 years.
Oh, happy birthday.
Yeah, right. you know, it's a 13-year-old startup, which is crazy.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, this is how it works, right? I mean, I love it, right? I mean, I hate it and I love it. It's a pain, but I always say if you're having fun 60 to 70% of the time you're doing better than most people. Yeah. So go for it, right?
Absolutely.
It still works sometimes, but...
And how much capital have you raised? It's different than a SaaS company in terms of the capital needs.
Because we ship hardware,
yeah.
Right? So we've raised almost $100 million.
Wow.
Over 13 years.
And can you give me an idea of the scale at this point?
Yeah, I mean, well...
giving away proprietary
numbers.
Right,
I know. I don't want to get my investors will yell at me. But we are on track, at least from a revenue standpoint, that by this time next year we could be talking about an IPO.
Awesome.
Right. So you never know. A lot can happen in the macroeconomic conditions you can't control. Right. So it's. I'm gunning to be a company that's capable of going public. Whether or not we end up going public is
sure.
a different story. But that's
that's great. Congratulations.
We're approaching 200 employees. It's a lot bigger than it was me and three guys at a table making phone calls at one point. But
I want to give you a heads up. We did hit our time. Do you have another meeting, or can you go another five?
No, I'm good.
All right, cool. Awesome. Because yep. I certainly have more questions.
You're at a
scale now, a scale where you've seen a lot, you've mm-hmm. learned a lot, and it's certainly not your first technology startup.
Yep.
When you come into the office here, you can feel a certain vibe, and I feel like it's a very unique culture. When you talk about a tech startup, tech culture, and 13-year-old startup, it's very different than 13-month-old startup or 13-week-old startup.
Yeah, no, I'm a startup guy, so
yeah.
I think Scott and I, who I mentioned earlier, and again, we've been together since we were 19 at this point. I mean, literally, we've been quote unquote married longer than I've actually been married. So we've always done this, and one thing I've learned over the years is that you can't, like, as founders, you sort of set the tone of the culture, but that can't be done artificially, right? There's no, like, oh, we're going to be this kind of company. Like, if you're not actually that kind of person, or you're not willing to embrace those specific values, like, deep down, it'll never stick. It's just words on paper. It has to be authentic, right? And so,
otherwise, it's a ton of energy to try to be that person.
Yeah, it's
and fake it.
Yeah, and so for us, it's like, well, you start off hiring employees that like you want to work with because I'm expecting to spend a lot of time with these people, and if you do that successfully. And they see that, and they start to do it. Well, then, as the company grows, it's sort of building on that culture, not with no one ever having written down this is the culture.
Yep.
Right. In fact, come to that point in a second. That's what you see at scale today, right? I mean, I don't even have an office, right? My desk sits in with everybody else. My desk is in the corner. I give myself that privilege. Mostly because my voice is so booming that I'm on everybody's phone calls one way or the other anyway. But we're all out there. And look, sometimes it's the open floor plan concept, but that, again, not really intentionally. I mean, I never thought, well, we're going to do open floor plan. It was just like, well, it started off because it was me in a room, and then you added a few more people in a room, and then we just kept adding more desks in the room, and we're like, well, that works, so just keep doing that. It was like natural, right?
Yeah.
You didn't even think twice about it. And we... about almost 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, there was a group within Scale, and they wanted to prepare a presentation for our annual kind of all hands meeting, and it was around company culture. And I didn't hear about this at first, and then I caught wind of it probably after I'd already spent a few cycles worrying about it, and I thought to myself, oh my lord, like this sounds like a train wreck to me. Like it's going to be some cheese ball mission statement and all this garbage, corporate garbage is what I thought, right? Ironically that it's like, it's coming from the middle up, right? Not from like some top down, like go do this.
Right.
So I was just talking with Scott, and Scott's a big believer in corporate culture, and he also was like, I could feel the groan. Maybe he even actually groaned when I told him that I heard this was happening. He's like, well, I've learned over the years, there's certain things, like as a CEO, there's certain things like that it's harder to like get in and do, because I'll say something and everyone just like blesses it like it's the Pope's holy truth, right? And it's not, even though I'm just kind of making it a comment. And so like, I don't want to, like, if I go in there and say, well, I think the culture should be this, everyone's just going to be like, sir, yes, sir, and that's what it is. That's not what I want, right? So Scott's like, well, I'll get in there and I'll do this. And he was just sort of observing, right? And his, the people who were putting this together didn't even know, his whole role was to hit the kill button. Like, if this thing is going to turn into corporate stupidity, just kill it off. Right?
And corporate stupidity to you means something contrived, something...
Contrived, yeah. Contrived, fake. Like, people are going to see it, and it's just going to feel like...
Confetti and
garbage.
Balloons.
Yeah, like, and it's just like, I don't want people wasting their time. I don't know. It just felt so unauthentic. And I'd been in companies. I've seen, you know, companies where this is like, you know, they list, like, you know, honesty and integrity is their two top cultural values, and the CEO is getting hauled off to prison for, like, you know, faking the books, right? Like, oh, okay, that didn't really happen. And so went through this whole thing, and ended up doing a survey, and in the end, and on the side, Scott and I had written down, like, okay, well, what, you know, what are the things that we, you know, believe in here? And, you know, there was things like fun and innovation, right? I mean, it was... Effectively, Jeff and Scott, thinking back of when we hire those first employees, what are we looking for, right? And we're looking to do cool stuff with people we like, right? And to have fun doing it, right? And hopefully to, you know, make some money along the way, right?
Yeah.
That, you know, and it's not rocket science, right? That's what we're trying to do. And effectively, right, that's what came out of the process, right? And it was fairly moving to me. Probably far more moving to me than it was to the other people within the company, just because what came out of this whole process was what the culture actually was.
Yeah.
As opposed to, like, it wasn't forced. It was just like, that is what the culture is, and that's what people voluntarily said the culture was. And to me, that sort of proof that you don't need to do these kind of exercises, right? I mean, it was cool to see, but... You know, the culture is what the culture is, and, you know, you've got to embrace it. And, you know, look, as the company's gotten bigger, different departments, there's slightly different versions of that culture within departments. I mean,
sure.
Tech support and sales don't work the same way.
Yeah.
There is a foundational element, right? And that's really important. And that's what keeps it exciting for me to come in here and do stuff. Right?
Yeah.
You know, I think that before we started, you had mentioned, like, soft skills,
yeah.
right, as something. And I think, you know, if somebody's looking to get into a startup, you know, there's a number of things that I think make for a great startup and do actually cause some challenges as the company gets bigger. But one of the things that really makes for a great startup team is, you know, what I call the propensity of everybody to jump on the grenade. Like, a grenade rolls in the room and everybody jumps on it, right? That's what you're looking for, right? There's a problem, everyone's going to fix it, right?
Yeah.
And it's sort of the whole team. It's not anybody's job, right, to fix it, because there's a million things that have to get done in a startup, and you got a half a dozen people to do it, right? So there is no, oh, well, that's not my job, that's this guy. There's none of that, right? Now there's the negative version of that, which is, it's not my job, so I'm not doing it, right? The positive version is, this person is, it is their job, they want to do it, and now if I stay back, I'm not in their way, right? So,
right.
And so as the company grows, it's a balance, right? I mean, you can't have a 200-person company where a tech support call comes in and everybody jumps on the call, right?
Right.
And so, you know, that's where you get into the, you know, I'm going from a military analogy to a sports analogy, but the, you know, okay, everybody do your job, right? Like, and by do your job, it means... You trust that your teammates are going to do their job, and they will ask for help when they need it. You're never, it's not binary, right? You're not 100% in either camp. You have to be willing to do both, because, you know, people will see different things. So that's one thing, right? Is it just a willingness, almost a psychotic willingness, to pick up anything you see and run with it?
Yep.
Right. As well as, you know, to kind of go back to my early point, a willingness to make the uncomfortable phone call to the prospect, to an existing customer, to whoever, and ask stupid questions.
Mm-hmm.
You learn so much. I mean, that one conversation with the guy from Fenwick and West changed the entire direction of where we would have headed. a year of searching on Google for what we should do would have never unveiled that. In fact, it was basically the searching on Google that suggested we should just compete with VMware.
Right.
Right. Market share, market percentage, all that stuff, and nobody would have ever bought it. Right. You know, it apparently was a good idea because now, 13 years later, well, probably by that point, 7 years later, people were buying it, and that's what we do now. But it still took time for the market to catch up. Exactly. You had to get from A to B. And I think that's, from a technology entrepreneurship standpoint, certainly has been in my track record, is you tend to see where the market's going before the market gets there. And it's a real pain when you're there early. And it seems like we're always there early across all my company. Even when we're like making decisions intentionally to try to not be there early, you end up being early. But you're going to be cognizant of that, right? And asking some of these questions helps you, you know, kind of deal with that. But I always tell you, when you're writing a business plan, right, all of your business plan can be written by interviewing prospects, right? Because eventually that those conversations I had with Fenwick and West in data storage, and he said he'd spend 30% less. Well, then now I'm establishing the price. Like, what should we charge? Well, he just told me, right? Well, I told him 30% less, but then you start, well, what if it was 20% less? What if it was 50%? You know, you start figuring out what the real price is. You figure out the roles of the people who make the buying decision. You'd ask the question, oh, when you do buy storage, who do you buy it from? Do you buy that direct from us, or do you go through a CDW or one of these big vendors? And you start to figure all that out. Mm-hmm. And then when they say, oh, yeah, we use a particular reseller, well, who's that? Oh, it's this guy. You should call him. He'd be really interested in hearing about this, right? You just kind of, you know, you can build a whole thing. And then, you know, if and not every company is suitable for, like, venture capital or raising money at all, but when you do come to raise money, having been on both sides of these kind of pitches, made the pitches and heard pitches, mm-hmm. Having those little anecdotes, like me going in and saying the reason that we're pricing it this way is because I talked to Fenwick and West and they're the ones that told me to sell data storage, like that's worth infinite. Yeah, I mean, your credibility just went through the roof, right?
It's a lot better than I went on Google and looked up Google Trends.
Yeah, here's, you know, Gartner IDC research says blah, 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 blah.
Right.
And, you know, if you've been in the business, at least in tech, I assume other industries work the same way. I mean, all these analyst research reports are basically the amalgamation of the analysts talking to companies who are already in the space.
Yes.
And so, of course, those companies are going to feed them information that makes them look best, feel in the best position. You know, it may well all be 100% accurate, right? But they're not going to, you know, the data storage company is never going to say, well, you know, the market would really open up if somebody sold it for 30% less. Like, that's never going to show up in an analyst report, right? So you have to get that stuff firsthand. And by the way, firsthand is free and, you know, takes way less. It feels like it's a lot of work, takes way less time. And those little anecdotes are just, I mean, that's the gold of how you sell an investment in an early stage company, right?
What should other people know before working in a startup?
So let me answer that by first telling you what I tell entrepreneurs they should think about before they even start a startup, which is that you need to recognize that being an entrepreneur, a startup entrepreneur, is a lifestyle choice, not a career path. There is no such thing as work-life balance. There is only one thing, which is your life, which also happens to be your work, because it's you. Like, you are the company, you are whatever. It's gonna touch everything. There's no tracking hours of work. You know, now, this is my perspective, right? I have seen guys that are pretty good at you know, okay, well, they can take a vacation. I've been doing this for 25 years. I find that I can go away from the office for 4 days, maybe 5 days, and decompress. And by the end of that fifth day, I'm starting to get antsy because I want to know what's going on, right? Even though I don't want to be antsy, it's just like I, you know, and I'm not a controlling guy. Like, I'm not a micromanager in the least. It's just like I feel like a responsibility to the customer. I just like want to know, like, I need to keep things kind of, you know what's going on. And you know, some guys don't do it that way, but I do. And so you have to know that. And early on, look, it's not going to be a lot of weekends. You know, I remember when I was first starting Scale, and at the time I was active on Facebook, and I'm not anymore. But I remember I would always sit down and, like, I would, you know, I'd work all day on Scale, and then I'd go home. I'd eat dinner with the family. At the time I had little kids. I'd put the kids to bed, And, you know, about 8:15, I would log in. I'd just get on Facebook and I'd say starting second shift. And I would work from 8:15 to midnight or whatever. And I'd get up the next day and do it all over again. Just how it is, right? And so that's the lifestyle, right? And if it all feels like work, no good. And if you're the kind of person that likes to compartmentalize, like, this is my work life, my home life, my family life, I would just avoid. It's just not for you, right? There's 100% nothing wrong with leading your life that way. Like, this would just be a bad choice.
Right.
Like, it'd be like, you know, oh, I decide I'm going to become a professional surfer and I have bad balance. Like, that's a bad idea, right?
Yeah.
So now back to your question, right? If you're not the founding team or the founding entrepreneurs, you're not necessarily taking on that same level of responsibility. But on a spectrum of I'm punching it in from 9 to 5 every day and going home versus there is no work-life balance, you're going to be sliding toward the no work-life balance, right? The jump on the grenade, the customer call comes in at 8 p.m. and I'm sorry, everyone, I got to jump in and do this thing. And if that feels too much like, again, like work or like something that's unnatural, maybe not for you, right?
Yeah.
You know, because like I said, on one hand, one of my soft pieces of advice, soft skill advice, is to say when the grenade rolls in the room, you know, go out of your way to jump on it, right?
Yep.
And again, you're probably not going to fake it, right? Not more than a couple of times, right, where it's like unnatural for me to jump on it. If you don't like it, you don't like it. You know, I do think, though, that, you know, if you're the kind of person, and a lot of people fall into this category, it's what draws a lot of people to earlier stage companies, which is they can see the direct connection between their work and the outcome of the company or for the customers and so forth, right?
Mm-hmm.
Again, that's going back to that's what was no fun with the hedge fund, right? I mean, I could see their bank account changing, but that was not that exciting, right? So. So people like that. Otherwise, you know, sometimes they work in big, you know, Fortune 500, and they say, I work on this stuff and nothing ever happens with it. I never see anything. I wrote code 3 years ago. It hasn't made its way into the product yet. It's frustrating. That won't happen at a startup, right? I mean, a startup, if you're an unpaid intern during your sophomore year, your code is probably going into the product, right? So that's really rewarding. It all goes hand in hand, though, right? Your code going, like, so I'll use the engineering thing, your code going into the product also means when the code breaks and the grenade rolls in the room, you got to jump right back on that thing, right? And that's got to be okay. So, you know, there's an appealing aspect, which is, yes, I like the idea of my work being, I mean, who wouldn't, right? I like my idea of my work being more connected. That comes with the territory, right?
Yeah.
But that is what it's like. There's also
you can make a bigger impact, but also your actions or inactions have a bigger impact.
Correct. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's a good way to put it. Your actions and inactions have a bigger impact, and you're shouldering a greater responsibility, regardless of what your job title says or anything like that.
Yep.
Right.
The upside of that too is, well, at least for a lot of early stage companies, is sharing in the upside as a co-owner.
Correct. Yeah. And that's part of it. And, you know, we've taken the approach always at scale that, you know, everybody has some kind of stock options, like, mm-hmm. up and down the board. And it's been very important. And, you know,
you're pretty ahead of the game with that here in the Midwest.
Yeah. I started a couple of companies in Silicon Valley. And so, you know, that's like how it got structured. And I carried that over. It's interesting. I've seen, you know, in some recent trends, there's a bit less of that now happening even in Silicon Valley, where they're sort of concentrating equity ownership only among kind of executives or so forth. You know, so I'm either ahead of the game or old school, depending on your viewpoint, where we still kind of spread it around. You know, again, to me, that's natural with this jump on the grenade kind of aspect. And I think that there's, again, jumping on the grenade can get in people's way. Like I said, as far as culture at scale computing goes, we lean more to the it's better to jump than not jump.
Yep.
Right. Try not to jump unnecessarily, but if no one else is jumping on that grenade, jump on it. Right?
Yeah.
And we'll kind of, you know, work from there. So, you know, the other thing I think is probably obvious is that, you know, startups have a lot of emotional ups and downs, right? The obvious thing is money, right? So you could join an unfunded startup or a newly funded startup. But, I mean, look, a startup's always running out of money, right, in some way, shape, or form. So, you know, you might get lucky, right, might be something. But, I mean, you look at something, I mean, you know, I mean, Uber, the fastest growing company of all time, is still losing money, right? So,
yeah.
You know, not every business works that way, but that happens because you have that direct, you know, seeing your work being put to use also means you're going to see when your work didn't work and mm-hmm. other people's work didn't work or the sales guy didn't sell something because there's probably only one sales guy and it's probably also the CEO or whatever, right? I mean, you're going to see a lot of this stuff and that can be emotionally challenging, right? You know, there's a lot of people think they want to know everything that's going on in a business they work for. Few of them probably really want to know everything that's going on, right? Because there's a lot more uncertainty than they probably would expect. You know, you work at I mean, looking out the window at Eli Lilly, I'm not throwing them under the bus, but yeah. If you work at Eli Lilly, you probably don't have any real idea unless you're in the finance office at the high level, like, is Eli Lilly, you know, about to bust through some kind of debt covenant or something? Who knows?
Yeah.
Right? You know, in a startup, you could be doing tech support in a 5-person startup, and you're going to know, right?
Yeah.
And that's challenging. But then it's you know, you also get to live on that upside. So if the rush you get out of being on the upside outweighs the downside, right? I think that helps. I think you know, it's funny. I consider myself a fairly emotionally stable guy. You know, I'm kind of even keeled. I think that helps me. You know, on the other hand, I've seen, you know, some notoriously very successful entrepreneurs are like wildly unstable emotionally, right?
Right.
So I don't think it's necessarily just that, right? But there is a tolerance.
That'll certainly have an effect on culture.
Oh, 100% it does, right?
Yeah.
100% it does. I mean, yeah, we all, at this point, you know, read all the stories about Steve Jobs. And, you know,
sure.
I know guys that work at Apple. And, you know, I know one guy, I won't name him, but, you know, he was in a meeting. And the first thing Steve did in the meeting was pulled a coffee carafe, his old school coffee maker, right, where he had, like, the glass carafe. He, like, pulled the thing off and threw it at him in the meeting, right? So yeah, that's not going to – well, I hope the guy doesn't have it at scale, right? That is not my approach.
Yeah.
Obviously – very successful with that, right? So it's you know, it can all work, right? And again, companies of wildly different cultures have success. One thing I would say, if you are looking at joining a startup, you know, go in there and interview them and just, I don't know, if it's a small enough company, just feel the vibe, right? And see if it fits.
Interview the startup.
Yeah, 100% interview the startup, because you're going to be heavily invested in it, and yes, maybe your stock options become worth $100 million. That can happen, right? We know those stories, but you know, the odds are that won't happen,
mm-hmm.
right? You want some upside, and we all love to get some upside, but the odds are it won't happen, so put yourself in the mind, if it doesn't happen, was this still worth doing?
Right.
Right. I think that's the best way to look at it, because... you know, if you're like, oh well, but I love the product and the people and the culture, whatever that culture might be, right? Because not everyone fits in every culture, whatever that is. If it's, again, if you're having fun 50, 60, 70% of the time, it's not bad, right? So, yeah, it's funny. Like you see, you know, one of the things when we're doing this could go back to the culture thing. So, Scott did a little bit of research on what other companies said about their cultures, right? To compare, mostly because we were, again, checking to see if this was all a bunch of BS or not. But, you know,
very skeptical employer branders.
Exactly, right? And so Scott, one of them I remember, he had a few little bits, but for Uber, one of the stated cultural values was they used the word fierce, right? And I'm like, yeah, I guess so, right? That that actually shows up, right? In compared to, like, I don't know what Lyft said, but I mean, you know, now they at least back, you know, before the CEO changed, like, they kind of took on this persona of, like, bad guys, good guys, right? And fierce was,
took on that,
you know,
connotation.
Was in there.
Yeah.
And, you know, the culture of Amazon versus the culture of Google, they're not the same, Google, sorry, is not the same thing, right?
Yeah.
They're both wildly successful. Both great places to work if it's the right fit for you. I would be very skeptical that somebody would work at Amazon and work at Google and say they were a fit for both. I don't think my understanding of those cultures is that they don't overlap all that much, right?
Right.
So, again, nothing wrong with it, but just interview that startup and get a sense for it. You know, talk to some people who work there. you know, you can learn a lot by talking to people who may used to, don't work there anymore, with the grain of salt that maybe they got fired and, you know, whatever. But, you know, if you hear things that are interesting and appealing from people who don't work there anymore, that's a pretty good sign that's probably still, it's probably what's going on in there.
Yep. Right?
So, and there is all, the other thing is, in my experience, companies go through a number of changes. Like a company that is 10 people feels different than a company of 30 people. And I picked those numbers specifically. There's a change that happens after 10, in my experience. There's another change that happens after about 30.
Mm-hmm.
And then a 30-person company seems to ride out to around 100 or so.
Yep.
And then it changes again, right? So if you come in and you're like, I love this, like, 8-person company, and they show you the business plan that says it's going to grow. Now, growth is exciting, right? There's nothing wrong with that, but it is going to change.
Yeah.
Right? And
be ready for that.
Be ready for that change. And, you know, try to embrace the change. And if you find out it's not for you, well, there's plenty of other 10-person startups that need help, right? You
Absolutely.
Can switch to them. And, hey, if you find out later that you really liked the 30-person or the 100-person feel better, those are still early-stage companies. Favor those, right? They all do feel a little bit different. So
yeah, that's good perspective. I've definitely experienced that myself at various tech startups. Last question for you before we break, and I think we're gonna have to do a part two here because I know we're only scratching the surface.
Yep.
What are you most excited about at scale right now, or in tech in general?
Well, so at scale, my view is going to be basically one and the same. There's other things in tech not related to scale I'm also excited about, but it scales specifically. So we've evolved the business in 13 years in IT effectively. That's a multi-generations of stuff, right?
Yeah.
And so the business evolved into what's now called edge computing, which you had mentioned earlier. And edge computing is a fancy way of saying anywhere I need to run applications outside of the data center, right? So, you know, I'm gonna group the cloud into the data center, right? So the joke all of us in the industry have is the cloud is just another word for somebody else's computer. So it's still there's still a data center, stuff is running there. It's managed a little differently, right? But it's there. The edge means it's outside of those. When you think about a data center has, whether it's a regional data center or the cloud, there are certain things that you can take for granted, right? Which is, it's got redundant power, and it's got good internet connectivity, and it has people there to do stuff, and it's got cooling, and, you know, nobody starts a data center because they're trying to, save the environment with low utility bills, right? It's like the opposite of that. So you've got a certain framework to work in. When you start talking about, I'm going to run these applications outside of that environment, so as an example, we do a lot in retail. Right, so you get grocery stores, coffee shops, gas stations, et cetera, that now need to run applications locally for a number of reasons, right, which I can get to. But they're going to run those applications locally on stuff that's running locally. Well, guess what they don't have there? There's no IT administrator in the back of a McDonald's, right? The physical size of servers, which makes almost no difference in the data center, suddenly makes a tremendous difference, right? You can't put a rack of gear in the back of a coffee shop. Not going to work, right? The power consumption, the noise that it makes, the heat, all these things, these matter a lot. And so scale, we play in all these markets, data center, cloud, some, and edge. But where we're very strongly positioned is that, as we kind of alluded to along the way, some of my background is in artificial intelligence. And machine intelligence. And so there's a foundational element of the scale product built around machine intelligence, which shows up as it's really easy to use.
Mm-hmm.
But what's really happening is when things break, which they break in IT all the time, that's why you have IT people,
yep.
Right? When things break, the system is designed to detect that and fix it by itself, which is now, you know, it was really cool when we were selling into data centers, especially if it were a smaller company that may have had only 3 or 5 IT people, because that automation enhanced their, it was like a 6th or 7th person, right? when you go out into the edge where there's no IT people, that automation is the killer app.
Yeah.
Right? And so...
Can we get that installed in all of our mom's laptops?
Yeah, exactly, right? So she might have to carry around, like, three laptops, but I could make it work. So, yeah, it's funny you say, because I still do tech support for all my family. Like, you know, I do scale, but I'm also, like, the family tech support. So the, you know, but being able to...
Moms and dads alike.
Yeah, of course, yeah. So being able to run those applications and know, right, so if it's the application that's running the cash register at the grocery store, like, and the server goes down, like, then you can't take people's money. That's bad,
right?
So some people say, well, what about the cloud? Well, what if the grocery store loses its connection to the internet, right? We're not talking about a data center here. We're talking about a grocery store that probably has a Comcast cable modem connection to the internet. It might lose that connection, you know, and then the other reason that this stuff runs locally tends to be speed. So, you know, the joke we use in the industry is if you have a Tesla or some other self-driving car and an animal runs out in front of you in the road, you don't want the Tesla asking Google if it should stop. Right. That decision needs to be made locally. And part of it's a matter of physics. Right. That if you're in New York and you're hitting a San Francisco based data center at the speed of light, that's going to take 50 to 100 milliseconds. I don't know what the exact number is. Right. But it's in that range. If you're going 70, 80 miles an hour, you've gone 15 feet by the time that data packet comes. Too late. Right.
Yeah.
You need that decision to be made locally. And there's a lot of that. Right. You're seeing cameras get deployed everywhere. Cameras generate a lot of data, which can easily saturate, right? I mean, putting a drop cam in your house is one thing, but if you're, you know, I'm a factory and I put in 1,000 cameras to look at all kinds of stuff in the factory, right? There's a lot of data there. You're trying to make decisions locally. And so this big rise now of edge computing, it's effectively the next, you know, everyone now knows the cloud. This is the next thing, right? So you had mainframes, then you had client server infrastructures, then you had data centers, the cloud, now you're getting edge computing, right? And when you look at, what I'm most excited about as it relates to scale, is if you look at each of those different generations, the company that you think of, when I say mainframes, you think IBM, right? If you're a tech person, maybe if you have no idea what I'm talking about, you don't think of anything, but if you're a tech person, you think IBM.
Sure.
That's because IBM wrote the software that made the mainframe work. They also built mainframes, but it was the IBM software that kind of made it all work. When you think client server architecture, if you're an IT person, you think Microsoft,
yeah.
Right? So that's how Microsoft worked. You start running Exchange servers in the back of your office and so forth. When you think data centers, you think VMware, right? And the opportunity for scale is when you think edge computing, you think scale computing, right? And so big upside to be effectively the operating system that runs everything. And that's, you know, I did not predict when I wrote down in that notebook, compete with VMware, I did not predict edge computing as a thing.
Sure.
Right?
That's evolved.
It's evolved and we've changed and, you know, and it's fortunate that we're in the place that we are, but it's not completely by happenstance, right? I mean, we were evolving and adjusting and it happens to be like all of a sudden our product and the market like perfectly aligned, right? But VMware was the previous generation of that software, and now here we sit with something that fits this next generation much, much better, and that's what I'm most excited about. And, you know, some of the other things I'm excited about in tech, you know, are really in related areas. I mean, you know, the, you know, automation, robots, all this stuff. All this stuff, effectively, we're talking about the applications that do tie into the edge.
Yeah, totally.
You know, I joke, some of the, we have a grocery store customer and they have some of their kind of beta stores, if you will, do have robots that stock shelves and stuff. And
that's
I always
cool.
say, well, if the scale thing goes offline, the robot's going to start killing people, right? But, you know, go rogue. But, you know, so there's a lot of really cool stuff happening. You know, I think that, you know, if I think about where we are today, I think that, you know, drones and, you know, robotic automation using cameras and laser-based radar and that kind of thing. That to me today is where I was with kind of that Atari and that bulletin board system back in 1982, right?
Yep.
I think we're at the very beginning of where all that stuff is, and you know, and the you know the kids who are getting into that stuff now. You know, they're the ones that are going to put old guys like me, like you have to retire, right? Because I'm like, I'm too far separated. Just like I was an old mainframe guy, and all of a sudden these guys are showing up with this other stuff, right? It's, you know, that I think is a really cool area. you know, we'll see. So
the world's going to be shaped along the way. That's it for today's show. Thank you so much for listening. A huge thank you to Jeff Reedy for coming on the show today. Be sure to check out Jeff and his company, Scale Computing, at scalecomputing.com. For links to Scale Computing and all the social profiles and all that good stuff, sounds like Jeff's not on Facebook anymore, but we'll get all the other ones on there. Head on over to powderkeg.com, check out the show notes. You can subscribe at powderkeg.com/iTunes. And then finally, to be among the first to hear about the stories about entrepreneurs, investors, and other tech leaders outside of Silicon Valley, continue to subscribe, pay attention for the next episode. We would love a review, and we'll catch you next time on Powder Keg Igniting Startups.